The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 24th of October, 2018. On the podcast today, I have David Smith, Chief Executive Officer of IQAI. Ticker there is IQAI. And David discusses why they filed a patent for gadolinium-free MR imaging of the brain and other organs recently. We also cover progress at the company. Plus, I also have on Richard Prickett, Finance Director at Landor Resources, LND. And Richard talks about the new gold occurrence along strike at the BAM gold deposit at their Junior Lake property in Canada. I also have John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talking about commodities copper, palladium, vanadium, and niobium, which I've never heard. And I don't even know if I pronounced it correctly, but we talk about that anyway, how it could be even a replacement for vanadium. And as always, I have a top five most followed list, so top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. And there's a company at number one, I think the fourth day in a row. That's quite good there. And also, I cover the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see both these lists, top tens of these lists, on the front page of Vox Markets, which is voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to know which companies are about to list on the London Stock Exchange? To see an up-to-date list of all the new and upcoming London IPOs, please visit voxmarkets.co.uk/IPO-watch.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Smith, Chief Executive Officer of IQAI. Ticker there is IQAI. Quite simple. David, thanks for coming on.
Good afternoon, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. And I'm sure there'll be quite a few shareholders glad you're coming on, because there's been a lot of changes, a lot of things happening at the company of late. And I've had direct messages from people saying, get the guys on from IQAI. I said, well, I'm trying, but you're here. This is good news. Now, for people not so familiar with the brand, give them a brief summary. What is IQAI all about, please, David?
Absolutely. Well, we're in the medical imaging business. So what we do is we produce images typically for radiologists and typically for people either with cancer or some other sort of disease within their body. We provide smart software that helps the radiologist to interpret those diseases and give much more accurate diagnosis. We have two principal businesses, which we have acquired over the last year and a half. The first of those was StoneChecker, and I believe Nick Stevens has spent some time with you, Justin, yep, talking about that in the past. But StoneChecker actually uses software to look at kidney stones and to predict the likelihood with which they'll break up using an ultrasound procedure called lithotripsy. Mm-hmm. And it's a very smart software that really helps the urologist figure out whether he's going to invest the time, the discomfort for the patient, and the money in actually doing this lithotripsy procedure to see if the kidney stone's going to break up. The other side of our business, which was an acquisition made earlier this year, is a company named Imaging Biometrics. They're based in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin, not far away from where I'm talking to you from now. Imaging Biometrics are focused on the brain, and they produce very pretty pictures, but they have a functional component too. They help neuroradiologists or brain doctors to figure out whether what they're seeing is a progression in the growth of a brain tumor, or whether in fact the radiotherapy and chemotherapy being used on that patient are having a beneficial effect.
Absolutely. Okay. And you've recently announced some news. Before we get into that, the news, David, give us an example of the size of markets that you're into here.
Well, I mean, the markets are in the region of $4 to $5 billion. If we're talking about medical imaging software worldwide, it's $4 to $5 billion, depending on exactly how you define it, worldwide. And as is fairly typical in these markets, about half of that opportunity is in the United States and half is outside the US.
Yeah. And I assume, is it relatively new, this kind of imaging algorithms?
Well, ever since we've had the ability to look inside the body, either using magnetic resonance or MRI or CT scans, computed tomography scans, which use X-rays, we've needed to have some form of software to figure out what's going on. Now, In the early days, those pieces of software were actually part of the machine. They were sold by the people that sold the big machines. Mm-hmm. But more recently, the last 20 years or so, you've had more and more specialized companies grow up with better interpretations of those images, and really companies that are focused on producing the software rather than the hardware associated with imaging.
Yeah, yeah. And just before we go into this news, I mean, so where are you in both parts of the business? At what stage in your development or commercialization are you?
Okay, well, let's take StoneChecker first, since that was the first company acquired. StoneChecker software has been distributed to a number of key European research hospitals to gather data to make the product better, and that it is a process of continual improvement. The more data you have that suggests that this is what's going to happen to this kidney stone, mm-hmm. and then you correlate that with data of what actually happened after the doctor did the lithotripsy procedure, obviously the more you can improve the product, the more predictive, the more accurate it becomes. StoneChecker, we applied for a 510K with the FDA on August the 22nd. 95% of those, according to the FDA's own website, are actually approved within that 90-day period. And if that was the case, that would give us an approval before the end of quarter four, before the end of December this year, which would then allow us to start selling StoneChecker in the United States.
Okay.
For imaging biometrics, we've had an FDA approval for around 8 years. And that's for the IB Neuro suite of products. And those products have been sold to customers like the Mayo Clinic, some of the leading teaching hospitals in the United States. We recently signed an agreement to expand the use of that technology into the liver area with the University of Alabama, and we announced that just about a month ago now.
Okay. Well, let's go into this bit of news. You've filed a patent for contrast-free imaging. What does this mean?
well, typically, if you're a patient and you're going in to have a scan on your brain, and let's hope that doesn't happen to many of us, mm-hmm. What happens is to enhance the image that the radiologist sees and to allow him to make a better diagnosis, you're injected both before the procedure and during the procedure with a contrast enhancer, something that makes the picture clearer for the radiologist to make his diagnosis. That contrast contains an element called gadolinium. And gadolinium is, that's a mouthful, but it's a metal, it's a rare earth metal, and compounds of gadolinium are what's called paramagnetic or faintly magnetic. And it's that magnetism, when used with a magnetic resonance imaging machine, an MRI machine, that allows you to enhance the image for the radiologist to make his diagnosis. Now, the problem with these agents is that, A, they're uncomfortable because you have to be stuck with a needle to actually inject it. But B, and perhaps slightly more concerning, there's an emerging picture of toxicity associated with these agents. They've been shown to be present in the body for years after the original injection. So they're retained by the body rather than being cleared through the kidneys. There's also examples of kidney damage that's created as this gadolinium is cleared through the body. So it stands to reason that if you were able to produce an image that eradicated the use of gadolinium, that would be a good thing. And we've been able to do that in an experimental situation at our U.S. subsidiary, Imaging Biometrics. We take non-gadolinium images or non-contrast agent images, and we process them in a new way, which gives the radiologist the exact same view that they would get as if they had put this contrast agent into the patient. So that's the theory, that's the discovery, that's what we filed a patent on, and the next step is to run some clinical studies and then go through the normal process of obtaining an FDA clearance for the product.
Right, and I assume it's safer, healthier, and it's more cost-effective, is it?
Oh, absolutely. So if you look at the U.S., there are an estimated 39 MRI images performed in the U.S. in 2016, and that equates to about 19.5 million MRI procedures that used contrast agents. So if you take a dose of each contrast agent of costing about $60 each, the direct material expense is roughly $1.2 billion a year, and that's in the U.S. alone, and that's not including the expensive things like the injector that's used to inject the contrast agent, which is about $100 per patient in addition. So it's a huge market. It could save both the National Health Service and in fact, health authorities around the world hundreds of millions of dollars. So we're very excited about the opportunity to bring this to the market. And I think it'll be a cleaner, healthier, more effective, and far less expensive way of dealing with these patients. And in our experience, if you have all these things lined up, you do something that's better for the patient, easier for the doctor, and less expensive for the health authority, then you've got a winner on your hands. And that's exactly what we think we've got with this contrast-free imaging.
Yeah. Well, I assume because you're filing this patent that no one else has done it, but it seems like almost a no-brainer, really, you know? I mean, no yes, pun intended there, of course.
Pun intended, I'm sure. Yeah. The yes, and of course, it now goes through the patent review with the U.S. Patent Office, and that process takes about 18 months. But it's pretty clear to us that we have what's in the patent world is called prior art. So we are the first movers in this area, and that's very important. And we use actually elements of our artificial imaging and machine learning in the development of this product. So it's computers almost starting to think for themselves, which has led us to this discovery.
Yeah, and what do you say the timeline on this was, this patent being approved?
Typically, it takes about 18 months.
Okay.
But that doesn't hold up your commercial development. Providing you can look back over your shoulder and say, we were the first ones to file, then the protection, the invention is protected.
Okay, and as far as general sort of, you know, significant milestones just ahead of you, what's next then, David?
So coming up ahead of us, we have the 510K for the stone checker product. Mm-hmm. That's going to be we believe before the end of this year. We then have a number of new developments that that obviously I can't tell you about right now.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I did my recent trip around to meet with investors in London, one of the things we talked about was upcoming coming soon attractions, and this gadolinium-free contrast agent is the first of those. We knew about that at that stage, but obviously I couldn't say anything. We've now announced it. We've got StoneChecker 510K coming up. We've got all sorts of software enhancements ahead of us for our existing products. And perhaps the biggest move is that we are moving from having a large piece of legacy software that we sell to the hospital that sits in its environment. We're actually moving to a click-fee cloud-based model. So instead of selling a $30,000 to $40,000 piece of software to a hospital that is somewhat static and stagnant as it sits in the hospital, mm-hmm. what we'll do is we'll move things to a cloud-based model where a radiologist will determine the area that he wants to look at specifically, send that data upstream over the internet to our diagnostic software, we'll send back the result in the matter of a second or two, and the radiologist will get the benefit of seeing many, many slices for which we'll charge a fee per slice. And obviously having that kind of setup, rather than the software sitting static in the hospital, every time you receive new information on an anonymized basis, you're able to improve the quality of your product. So if you know what you think you saw there, you tell the radiologist. He completes the feedback loop and tells you exactly what was there when you do your biopsy, then you can improve the quality of that product over time. And we're very excited about that change, and that's going to be coming in 2019.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, David, one final thing. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not following the story as yet, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Absolutely. Well, I guess the first one is it's a huge market and it's evolving very, very rapidly. The second one is that this is really a revolution in the way that healthcare is delivered, not the evolution, that slow creep that we've seen in the past. It's making a leap step change. And the third one is that we're leading the wave. As we're developing these products, we're realizing that we're right at the start of the wave. And obviously, the faster that you can develop your products, the more patients' anonymized data you have collected, the more accurate your product is, and then you've got a tremendous competitive advantage when dealing with other companies that are trying to sneak into the field. So we think we've got a tremendous first mover's advantage here.
Marvellous stuff. David, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thanks for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Prickett, Finance Director of Landor Resources. LND is the ticker there. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Morning, Justin. Thanks.
Now, you've had some decent news out about your BAM gold deposit. And as we talk, the share price and the market is welcoming this news by the looks of it. But in today's markets, who knows what's going to happen? But it's looking good so far. And we'll go into the details of what you released in a bit. Before we do, Richard, for people new to the podcast or not familiar with your company, could you give them a brief summary as to what you're all about, please?
Yeah, thanks. Landor's an AIM-listed mineral exploration company. Our total focus is on a deposit, the BAM gold deposit, on 100% owned property we have in Ontario, Canada, called the Junior Lake property. We've been drilling this summer. We've had resource updates, and we're in the process of doing further resource updates and a preliminary economic assessment.
Yes, okay. Well, take us through. So you've released this news. You've got a new gold occurrence along strike. Take us through the details of this, if you could, Richard.
Yeah, well, this summer, Justin, we've been drilling along the existing strike length of the deposit to increase the resources. We announced earlier on this year that after some remodeling, the resource was approximately 623,000 ounces of gold. And we've been drilling on the east and west end and also infill drilling of that deposit with a to bring it up to a target of approximately 1 million ounces. At the same time, we have done some exploration drilling at each end of this structure to see if we can extend it and see if it does extend it. And before this morning's news, we had a 2 kilometer strike length. After this morning's news, we now have a 3 kilometer strike length. So we've established through drilling that this goes now for 3 kilometers, which is a really significant distance. We have got 31 kilometers of this structure going through our property. We've done a lot of geophysical surveys across that 31 kilometer stretch, not all of it because some of it's still unexplored. And we firmly believe that although we've got this now to 3 kilometres, there is a significant chance of this going much, much further. So very exciting news this morning. And some of the actual hole results are really positive. We've had one intercept of 26 grams per tonne, another one of 32 grams per tonne. So we're getting high-grade ones as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, going forward now, looking forward to news that's going to be coming out, what's next? What's the next sort of big milestones you're hoping to achieve?
Right, well, the two next big milestones is these are the final results from the drilling campaign, and okay. These are being collated and given to the technical consultants to produce the upgrade on the resource. We expect to have a resource estimate out in before the end of the year, probably late November, early December. And as soon as that is completed, that will form part of the preliminary economic assessment, which we're also doing, and we're doing a lot of the technical work, such as metallurgical studies and so on, and that will be out in the first quarter of next year.
Yeah, and I see, I don't know if you're keeping your tabs on it, but you probably are, but of late, with a bit of uncertainty in the markets, gold has been a bit more buoyant, isn't it?
Well, gold, it seems to be reacting a little bit to some sort of geopolitical tensions around, and there are plenty of them. We've spoken before, I'm always very positive about gold, and I feel that it will sort of jump out of this range and we could see a very nice result from gold, because there's so much uncertainty around the world that I think people will eventually start thinking, well, let's have a bit more gold, and that can only be good for us. But we're looking at a low cost operation, so even at sort of gold prices at this level or even lower, we should be profitable. And if it goes up, then that's really nice to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's going to happen here is, I mean, you know, the interest rates are going up, which of course is not particularly good for gold, but that will slow economies down. And I mean, I think Trump is really annoyed at the Fed threatening to put interest rates up. I mean, and when economies start slowing down, of course, there's a flight to sort of to havens like gold, and it always happens. And I think when you see a commodity that traditionally, you know, one you should always have in your portfolio or exposure to, when you see a commodity like gold overlooked or for a while, then that's the time to start researching and looking for exposure to gold, I find. You know, it's the best time to get in, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. And I just, whilst I'm talking to you, I've just seen our brokers of Sencos have issued a report this morning with a big buy on the top of it, so that's really nice to see as well.
Absolutely. Well, let's summarise, Richard. Three reasons. If someone's listening to this right now, like the sound of what you're doing and the progress you're making up there, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Right. Well, we're very advanced on this project. I mean, we're moving swiftly through to a resource update and the PEA, and we're funded for that, so we're not looking to the market for any funding at the moment. That's number one. Number two, I personally believe the shares are very cheap. They have come down recently, and although they've gone up a bit this morning, they've got further to go up to even get to what they were. So they're cheap, and our brokers think they're cheap. And I think, you know, perhaps for people who don't know us, Bill Humphreys and myself have got quite a long track record in this business, and we've been successful in monetizing a project like this before, where we were able to take it to a good resource level and sell it out to an industry buyer for a very large sum. So we know what we're doing there. So I hope that those are three reasons that will encourage people.
Excellent stuff. Richard, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, good. Thank you.
I've just received your morning note, which is an interesting read always, to look at some of the prices. And you mentioned palladium in there. And in fact, before we get onto that, you were just chatting about copper and BHP taking a bit of a slice out of SolGold.
Well, BHP last week decided to put another £45 million into SolGold. And, you know, I think this tells us some interesting things. First, it says that they like the SolGold project at Cascabel, or the Opala project at Cascabel in Ecuador. They must feel reasonably comfortable about the direction that's going in. And that's quite a deep level project. The real mineralization starts from about 500 meters down. So it's got to be a huge multi-billion dollar project, maybe even $4 or $5 billion of capex. And we don't know the numbers yet, but it's a big expensive project. And BHP is saying we want a seat at the table here, and we think this could be one of the next, you know, the leading next generation project to be developed. So it gives us some important messages, and it says we're not finding other better projects around in the world at the moment. So we better make sure we've got a slice of this, because this may be what we have to do going forwards. And when we as analysts look around the world at other copper projects, there's quite a lot that are about 0.3%, 0.35% copper. But there isn't much that's in good places that looks more exciting than that. So BHP are saying, well, you know, we have to have a big project to move the needle on, you know, from a board perspective. And therefore, if we want big scale, we've got to go into something like the Alpala project, which SolGold owns, to be there. And I think this is symptomatic of the industry that we're in now, is that metals prices are not high enough to support these projects in at the moment. So those metal prices are going to have to go up. Otherwise, we're not going to have the metal to work with going forwards.
Yeah. It's you know, it's another. I mean, there's quite a few bullish copper stories around him, and it, like you said there, you know, when you get one big major, you know, needing a slice of copper, saying, "Well, listen, we've looked around the projects, and this looks like one of the best around for us to take a stake in," then all of a sudden it becomes this. I can almost sense it that other majors think, "Hang on, we need exposure to copper. You know, we need to look around." And this in itself, I mean, there is. I mean, that you know, fundamental crunch coming for copper that everyone talks about, but it creates this almost rush, doesn't it, for the sort of copper stuff. And And because, you know, there isn't the projects around. Like I said, can it sustain this demand that's going to happen? You know, the copper, I don't know if it can. But nevertheless, it's almost, it begets buying, doesn't it? One's a major, taking an interest in one project begets others, you know, and it brings up an interest, doesn't it, around the industry?
Well, for example, if I want to buy an electric car and then charge that up in my drive, I'm going to have to buy, effectively, quite a lot of copper to put in the cabling to do to for that charger. Mm-hmm. And that's going to happen with hundreds of millions of people around the world. And the chances are they're all going to rush out and want to buy that copper kind of within the same few years as electric vehicles become that much better. And actually being able to charge up at home is going to be much cheaper than buying fuel at the petrol station. So why wouldn't you want to do that? The economic argument will make sense. Yeah. And the copper price is going to have to rise an awful lot before you don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm very bullish on copper. You know, and like I said, looking around for exposure to copper is worth getting, I think. And anyway, let's move on to what your news has highlighted today, and that's palladium holds near its record level after touching $1,152 an ounce. What's the deal here, John? What's happening?
Well, the thing is, platinum prices are not so great. Mining companies have been shutting, not platinum, not the whole platinum company, but they've been shutting the shafts over the last 10 years that are mainly platinum rich. But of course, those mines, they produce platinum and palladium, mm-hmm. and there's some kind of ratio. And in the past, the value has always been driven by platinum. But I think some of these companies are going to have to look at perhaps reopening some of these shafts now that the palladium price is so much higher than platinum. And this is because auto catalysts, you know, the cars that we're buying today, we're buying more petrol cars than diesel cars, because of course we know the car companies have been lying to us about the emissions, and the policymakers are telling us that diesel is an evil thing to have in our cars. So we're buying more platinum, more palladium catalysts within our petrol engines, and so that's driving the price. And again, that says that the capital within the mining companies hasn't been cheap enough, or hasn't been available enough, to drive new investment in this area. And at the same time, a lot of the world's platinum and palladium is coming from South Africa, where the political environment has not been overly conducive for investment. The black economic empowerment stakes, the other things to do with the scorecards that they run over there, doesn't really make you want to invest an awful lot of money in the region. And of course, it means that the world is running a bit short on palladium, so the price is looking good.
Yeah, well, do you know what here it says in your note, John? This is very interesting, and I've been trying to listen and read your note at the same time, but I don't know who wrote this bit on palladium. Was it you, or was it one of the other guys, one of your team members, one of your minions?
This is the team, yes.
Like a team. I shouldn't say minion, team. But what's interesting is that you say platinum is used in diesel cars, palladium traditionally used in petrol cars. People are switching to petrol now, so that's spiking the price of palladium. But they can be changed. And this happened back in 2002 when palladium prices spiked. They switched in the mixture of palladium to platinum in the catalyst. So it can happen again. So they're saying now that platinum could spike off the back, because they're very interlinked, and platinum could spike off the back of this, because they can just switch. If it becomes too expensive for catalyst makers to use palladium, they'll just go back to using platinum. And so that can spike again. So, do you know what I'm just saying? I mean, I don't know what projects you know out there. Like you say, most of them are in South Africa, aren't they? Most of the projects.
Most of them are. There's a bit that comes out of Russia from Norilsk. But the catalysts are generally what's called three-way catalysts. They're platinum, palladium, and rhodium, and it's a mixture. And you tend to be palladium-rich for gasoline engines and platinum rich for diesel engines, and that works better. The fact is, if you put more platinum, palladium, and rhodium in a catalyst, it will just work better anyway.
Yeah.
And they make these catalysts specifically, they design them specifically to each engine. Mm-hmm. So once they're designed, the car companies don't really want to redesign them again. But it wouldn't surprise me if they were just throwing a bit more metal into the mix, because they really want to meet these emission standards now. They're taking them more seriously than they used to.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I'm invested in a company called Jangada. They've had a bit of a nightmare since IPO. The IPO at 5p, but the funding was delayed, and then there was rumours the funding wouldn't be done below 5p. Then it came out, funding was done at 3p, and it was attached with warrants, and obviously warrant holders, some of them sold their shares and just held on their warrants. So now we're down at 2.6p, but it's been rallying today. But they have a Brazil project. It was ex-Anglo, $35 million spent on it. But they got more palladium than platinum in the PGM. But they've also got copper. What else? Copper, cobalt, and nickel. They've also got that there. They have a massive area, massive exploration area. It's like 44 exploration licenses. And yet they've got everything there. It seems cobalt, copper. They've got a bit of vanadium. They're coming out with a copper and nickel resource before the end of the year as well. So they've also got the PGM side of it. But they're only like a 6 million market cap, and they've funded now. So I quite like that going forward, because I think either way, I don't know how much copper they've got there or nickel, but that's good to go, isn't it, for EV? And they've also got the platinum palladium play. So it's covering all bases pretty much, you know?
Well, I think There's quite a number of platinum palladium businesses around to look at. I mean, Lonmin was the traditional one to buy, but has had quite a lot of trouble in recent years. So let's hope it gets through all that and becomes the strong company that it was once again. And for those of us who remember the days of Tiny Roland, before the company was attacked by Dieter Bock, that really was a leading counter on the London Stock Exchange and a very good quality company back in its day.
Cool. Anything else you're looking at, John?
Well, we can't help but notice that vanadium prices jumped another 17% in China. The price in Europe hasn't moved so much, but I think it's because there just hasn't been metal to trade in Europe. So the prices, you know, can't react until there's some trading that goes on. The Chinese seem to have stopped exporting a lot of vanadium that they used to export, because they're using it all internally, with the increase in vanadium that's required for strengthening and hardening rebar. You can use a bit of niobium, and I noticed in substitution, but there isn't much niobium in the world either, and there's one big mine in Brazil that supplies about 80% of the world's niobium, and I don't know if that can really ramp up a lot more from where it is. And there aren't many other sources of that metal. So, and we think actually it's quite difficult to substitute vanadium for niobium, and only certain steel producers will be able to do it, and they'll only be able to do it at certain prices. And now the niobium price has spiked. It's unlikely to be much of a threat to vanadium. And we're struggling, really, to see where additional supplies of vanadium are going to come from. Now that the Chinese have cut out a lot of the vanadium byproduct that used to come from smelting poor quality iron ore and magnetite that had a bit of vanadium in it, and they've switched over to the Australian iron ore, which has very little vanadium but is much better quality. It's much higher grade. It's better material for the steel producers, and so it's a natural way for them to go. So this all this byproduct vanadium, which was something like 70% of the market, is just, well, much of it's just not there anymore, and so the world's going to need new vanadium mine and new primary vanadium production, and new byproduct vanadium from, let's say, from other sources. But it's going to take a couple of years for this to come in, so we're scratching our heads and trying to figure out where prices are going to go at the moment.
Yeah, niobium. I don't know much about niobium. A couple of things. All I know is it's formerly known as columbium, is a chemical element with a symbol NB, atomic number 41, soft grey, crystalline, ductile, often found in minerals like pyrochlore and or columbite. I'm just reading that. When you said niobium job, I'd never heard of it. So I just Googled it and I just read that off Wikipedia. But I'd never heard of niobium.
Well, niobium is often associated with rare earth mines. Mm. So I think that will help some of these rare earth miners get off the ground. You've got Makango, for example, with an important project in Malawi, and that's been quite well funded by Talaxis at the moment. So I think that's a good project going forwards. I mean, their principal products are for magnets, to be honest, but a bit of, there's usually a bit of niobium content in with these things. And there may well be other projects around the world where there's sensible niobium. There's one in Kenya, but Kenya is a difficult place to go mining in at the moment, because the government might like to renegotiate its projects on you. If you can find a good niobium project, that's well worth keeping an eye on, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, John, listen, you've educated me. I've never known anyone, anyone ever on Twitter or any social, they say go long niobium. Go long niobium. It's a very unknown or little known element, isn't it?
Well, when I first came across it, a fund manager told me that that he knew about niobium because it was used in body piercing rings. But I didn't want to find out exactly how he knew that.
Oh, there we are. That was quite popular of late. Maybe that's why you should go long niobium. Everyone's getting their body pierced these days. So there we are. Marvellous, John. Listen, as always, you've educated me. And even if we do that, even if you educate one person... probably a waste of time, actually. No, I'm only kidding. It's a wonderful experience. John, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak next week.
Very welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Anglo African Oil and Gas, AAOG. At four, Jangada Mines, JAN. At three, U Group, big faller today on a trading update. At two, Live Company Group. That's LVCG. Number one today, Totally. I did a video on Totally, and some big sellers in there. That's the trouble. The update today was very good. Contracts won, efficiency happening, so costs coming down, and also significant holders are on the way out. But they are using this today's liquidity, good news, to get out, and they're selling quite a bit of stock there. So it's suppressing the share price. But once they're gone, hopefully... it should start to head north. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Predator Oil and Gas. Predator presents at All Capital Conference, PRD. At four, proposed sale of non-core Mpoko gold project. That's Armadale Capital, ACP. At three, Valerix. Aligned Research initiates coverage. That's VAL. At two, Totally. Trading statement, TLY. And number one, most liked on us, even though the share price is down quite a bit, it's operational update and financing facility with Anglo African Oil and Gas. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.